The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. We're going to start today, as we typically do, with an essay from 80 Things to Do When You Turn 80. And remember, you don't have to be 80 to do these things. This one is called Aging into Selfhood. It's by Richard Anderson Bamford, who is a retired priest of the Episcopal Church. When I retired in my 60s, I tried to hide from my previous life as an Episcopal priest and pastor. I needed to be free from 24/7 responsibilities and availability. I had to do something different, so I signed up as a substitute teacher in the local school system. I chose the high school level, and after a few disastrous forays into middle school, I stayed with the upper grades where I felt more at home. For the most part, when I pretended that adolescent teens were really adults, they responded accordingly. I had a graying beard, and they enjoyed calling me Colonel Sanders or Abe Lincoln. Playing with my surname, some even had the nerve to address me as Mr. Bam Bam. I enjoyed their acceptance, and we chuckled together. When they spied me entering the building, they called out, "Who are you in for?" or simply, "Who are you today?" That question became the prevailing mantra of my life. Who indeed was I presuming to be? What role was I playing? Who was I becoming? My new job brought previously unused talents out of me, enlivened gifts I didn't know I had. I loved it when students asked me questions about my life and the world I grew up in. They had a hard time believing how one could grow up without television, copiers, computers, and cell phones. They couldn't comprehend a world in which hot dogs cost a dime and candy bars a nickel. And they tried to imagine life in my past. I relived my earlier days and grew into a new appreciation of my present being. My subbing days were to last almost a decade, but halfway through the first year, I was asked to fill in for ministers at one church after another. Having found school substituting to be an energizing sport, I also came out of clergy hiding and rediscovered the joys of pastoral ministry. It became clear that there was nothing boring about retirement. On the contrary, I was being needed, sought out, and appreciated by both my local school and church. Some in the latter even called me Father Bam Bam. To make things even better, all administrative details were being handled by others. I was aging into mature selfhood, entering into both the educational process of the young on weekdays and meeting the spiritual needs of myself and others on weekends. Other opportunities multiplied. I was asked to serve on challenging committees, to mentor other adults, to lead prayers in secular meetings like the state legislature and a college commencement. While my gray hair gradually turned pure white, I became more of what I was made and gifted to be. I was beginning to answer the high schooler's question, "Who are you today?" with the realization that I was becoming a richer, fuller self. I collaborated with my brother and my wife in editing a book about the life of my sea captain father. I wrote numerous articles and reviews for church publications. I've been reading up a storm lately, catching up on books I missed while I was, quote, working. I'm also spending more time now with my wife and children and grandchildren. I have left school and Sunday subbing to others. I'm getting a bit unsteady on my feet and thinking about using a cane, but nevertheless, I am enjoying my ever-emerging self. At 86 years old, I am still in process, or, with apologies to Descartes, I am becoming. Therefore, I am. Now, moving on to Centennial Living, the complete guide to heart health for those over 50, we're into a new section now. Can these drugs save your life? Statins and polypills both have well-documented benefits for heart health, but one may never be available. For years, statins have been the go-to treatment for lower high cholesterol and reduce the risk of complications that go along with limited blood flow to your heart. Many experts had such confidence in them that the lead author of a 2018 review in the Journal of American Medical Association said her research indicated statins could save tens of thousands of lives annually. But statins aren't the be-all, end-all. Lately, more cardiologists are talking about polypills. These drugs, which contain several medications in one, could save even more lives, according to some researchers, if they ever hit the market. Does that mean you need to get on one stat? We ask cardiologists to break down the options below. Keep in mind, medication, whether it's statins, polypills, or something else, isn't everything. Individuals have plenty of power to make their own lifestyle changes, eating better, exercising more, and maintaining a healthy weight, with an eye toward minimizing the need for medications. Later on, we will address eating habits and that sort of thing. Statins, the old standard. Statins first came on the scene in the U.S. in the late 1980s, when the FDA approved lovastatin for commercial use. Other statins on the market in the U.S. include Lipitor, Crestor, Izalor, and Zocor. These drugs work to lower cholesterol by blocking the production of this waxy fat-like substance in the liver. This reduces the likelihood that cholesterol will make its way into the walls of the arteries. As a result, statins help prevent cardiovascular disease in at-risk patients and treat and control the disease in those with it. They also help reduce the risk of stroke and heart attack because they prevent the buildup of cholesterol plaques in the arteries. These drugs are so popular that about 25% of Americans aged 40 and older take one. The evidence explains why. According to a statement from the American Heart Association, published in 2018, when taken at the maximum dosage, the most effective statins reduce bad cholesterol, LDL, by an average of 55 to 60%. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force also found that people ages 40 to 75 who have diabetes, hypertension, or abnormal blood cholesterol levels, or who smoke and also have at least a 10% chance of having a cardiovascular disease event, such as a heart failure or stroke, in the next 10 years, should be offered a low to moderate dose statin because of the reduced risk for heart disease. However, people who have a low risk of heart problems in the next decade likely wouldn't benefit from a statin. In an often cited study, researchers gave 15,000 patients in 26 countries either a statin or a placebo. These adults didn't have cardiovascular disease or high cholesterol, but they did have elevated levels of C-reactive protein, or CRP, a substance that is produced by the liver that indicates a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. After about 2 years, people on the statin not only reduced their CRP and LDL levels, but they also had a 54% lower chance of experiencing a heart attack, a 48% lower chance of stroke, and a 20% lower chance of dying from any cause. The downsides. Despite this evidence in recent years, statins have come under scrutiny. There are reports of side effects ranging from muscle pain to type 2 diabetes and even liver and cognitive problems. However, typically only in a small number of people in statin trials reported any side effects, and most aren't serious. Muscle aches are most common, Huffman says. Up to 10% of users experiencing them. They're usually mild, short-lived, and reversible. Only about 1 in 10,000 people will have severe muscle damage. If the statins increase the production of liver enzyme that signal inflammation, liver damage can occur, but this is also rare. Lastly, some people report problems with memory and cognitive function when they're on a statin. This feeling of fogginess, of not feeling sharp, is not permanent. If you stop taking the medication, the symptoms resolve. Furthermore, research hasn't found any clear evidence of a link between the use of statins and increased risk of cognitive dysfunction, dementia, or Alzheimer's disease. People who are at higher risk of cardiovascular disease are at a greater risk of vascular dementia and cognitive dysfunction. Hence, the problems that someone experiences on statins may actually be due to the underlying cardiovascular disease and not the medication. In fact, a 2020 meta-analysis of 30 studies with more than 9 million participants published in Neuroepidemiology found that statins may decrease the risk of dementia. Who should be on a statin? According to the American College of Cardiovascular and the American Heart Association, statins should be the first-line treatment to prevent atherosclerosis, which is the buildup of fatty plaques in the arteries, for anyone with an LDL of 190 or higher. People aged 40 to 75 who are living with diabetes, anyone with heart disease, and people of any age who don't fall into the above groups and who have a 10-year risk of heart disease of 7.5% or higher. These guidelines diverge from the more conservative USPSTF recommendations. Most cardiologists use the ACC/AHA guidelines. The bottom line? They are a really well-studied, low-cost strategy to prevent cardiovascular disease. Based on your age and risk factors, talk to your doctor about the possible benefits and risks for you personally. Now let's move on to an article in AARP, the magazine, about ideas for your forever home. Last week we started with project number one, and today we're going to do project number two, closet cleanup.
Ooh.
Tom Silva, general contractor and co-star of PBS This Old House. Too cramped, poorly lit, and sometimes even dangerous is how Silva describes most people's closets after a lifetime of collecting stuff. But a few improvements can turn your clothes and linen closets, storage spaces, and pantries into something worth showing off. Try it yourself. Think about what's not right with your current closet. Too much clutter? Set a 30-minute timer and make piles to keep, donate, and ditch. Have trouble finding or reaching things? Adding a double rod gives you twice as much hanging area, and you can hang things at your level. Silva also recommends adding adjustable shelving. You can buy tracks for pull-out shelves and sliding bins from the big hardware and organizing stores. For shoes, laundry, and other items that often pile up on the closet floor, inexpensive battery-powered puck lights or LED light strips under the shelves help you tell black socks from brown and find that belt that you need. A sturdy folding stepladder with hand grips gives you safer top-shelf access. Or you can call in a pro. Hardwiring a closet with a sensor light or one that illuminates when the door opens will make you go, "Why didn't I do this years earlier?" Silva says, a licensed electrician can add recessed lights outside the closet to brighten the entire space. A high-tech motorized closet system, picture your local dry cleaner, keeps everything neat and accessible at the push of a button. For now and forever, closet doors can be awkward and heavy for older homeowners. This person recommends moving doors for universal access, or a premium solution, swap out doors with motorized window blinds that can open on command. Let's go on to project number three here, Simple Bathroom. Nikki Boyd, who is a home decor expert and a best-selling author of Beautifully Organized and host of YouTube's At Home with Nikki, says, bathroom safety grows ever more important as you age, but you also want your bathroom to look great and be a true escape for me, me, me time. Boyd says, major overhauls get pricey fast, but Boyd and her husband use their quarantine status to upgrade their bathroom for just over $600. You can try it yourself. Rule number one with bathrooms, keep things minimal and bright. White paint, white surfaces on different levels, and full spectrum lighting along with large tiltable mirrors make a bathroom seem bigger and create a clean, safe environment for people of all heights and physical abilities. Instead of removing an old tub, Boyd updated theirs with white refinishing paint. Kits online cost around $50. That futurized the tub's throwback almond hue. They also painted a drab brown vanity white, prime it first so the old color won't bleed through, and swapped out nubby knobs for chrome pull handles that are both chic and easier to grip. Even a new shower curtain can feel like a renovation, and handheld showers with adjustable height add splash and function if you ever need to sit while showering. Some come with a grab bar rail system that mounts to the wall for safety. The final touch? Plants. They create an oasis feeling that makes you go, ah, she says. Or you could call in a pro. Talk to a contractor about a doorless, no-step shower that turns the bathroom into a resort-like treatment that will always be accessible regardless of future mobility needs. A rain shower head installed in the ceiling, or better yet, multiple shower heads, makes you feel like you're on vacation. Built-in shower seating is luxurious today and practical for tomorrow. Still feeling flush? Next upgrade? I would spring for a fancy bidet toilet. And the sidebar, for now and forever, a licensed contractor can install a toilet paper holder that's also a secret assist bar and a towel bar that won't detach if you really grab it, says Steve Cunningham, who is an aging-in-place specialist with the National Association of Home Builders, who also recommends a taller comfort height toilet that's easy to sit down on and get up from, more so than standard commodes. Now, let's take a look at some real people. This one is entitled Fast Friends, brought together by a historic storm. Nina Richardson and Doug Condon created a stranded deli or delivery driver. Let me start that one again. Nina Richardson and Doug Condon treated a stranded delivery driver like one of their kids. Nina Richardson, because of COVID, we'd been having groceries delivered to our home in Austin for nearly a year. Chelsea Timmons, I live in Houston, but I make extra money every weekend delivering groceries in Austin, 3 hours away. Nina and Doug were my last delivery that Sunday. Doug, it was Valentine's Day. The temperature dropped very quickly. Everything was icing up. Chelsea, as I turned into their long driveway, my car started sliding toward the house, and I couldn't stop it. Then I couldn't back the car out. The wheels just spun. I was stuck. Doug, I went out and told Chelsea to come inside and call a tow. Chelsea, I was a little nervous because I didn't know them, and then it turned out that the roads were too icy for a tow service to get to me. Nina, one of us said, you'll have to stay here overnight. Chelsea, they didn't even know my name, and they said, just stay. Doug, we've got 5 grown children. We just started treating Chelsea like she was one of our own. Chelsea, I was in touch with my parents in Houston, and they told me no one in my family had power. I started to realize that being stranded was a blessing in disguise. I stayed 5 days, Nina. By Friday, the roads got clear and Chelsea's parents had power. We all felt it was safe for her to leave. Chelsea. Saying goodbye was bittersweet. Their kindness just amazed me. I know we'll stay in touch. They acted like taking me in was no big deal, but it meant the world to me and to my family. Now let's look at the Rolling Librarian. These articles are from AARP, the magazine. College instructor Laura Moulton's mobile lending library connects homeless readers with literature and with the community. Our mobile library opened in 2011 after I got the idea to do a three-month project that combined my love of books with my interest in people who live outdoors or in shelters. At first, it was just me on a Haley tricycle that I found on Craigslist here in Portland, Oregon. My brother helped me add a drawer to the cargo box and decorate the bike with stencil art. It became very much a rolling case of curiosities, and that's what I wanted, to draw people in. I started showing up downtown twice a week, at the same time and places every week. I would park the trike, open the book drawer, and let people browse for reading material to borrow. Within a couple of months, I had a few volunteers helping out, which was huge because it was a bit of a lonesome endeavor at the beginning. By the end of the 3 months, we just didn't want to stop. I fancied myself very open-minded, and unsurprisingly back then, but I was quickly blown away by the caliber of conversations I was having with the patrons and by their book requests. In our society, we sometimes have a lopsided view of people who live outdoors. We tell ourselves stories about how they might have landed there, but those stories can overshadow what people have to offer. These are people with the grit to survive some really rough situations. One of the library's most reliable patrons from the start was Ben Hodge Hodgson, a veteran with a slight build and professorial glasses. When we first met, Hodge inspected the books and asked me, "What kind of librarian doesn't stock P.G. Wodehouse?" I got some of those books to lend him right away. Things have changed since then. Hodge now lives in a tidy apartment, and he is on the board of directors of Street Books. One of the most powerful things about the Tricycle Library is the way it brings people together. A housed person might stop and ask, "What is this contraption?" I've witnessed so many conversations between a person like that and, say, a borrower who has come to get the sequel to a book they've just read. Those two people might fall into conversation, talking about this or that author, and each of them might learn something from it. What do I wish I had known at the beginning of all this? I guess how rich and wonderful it was going to be. That would have helped me get through some of the dark, drippy days when I was by myself. That would have helped sustain me. Laura Moulton is 50, and she's an adjunct professor at the Northwest Writing Institute at Lewis and Clark College and the executive director of Street Books in Portland, Oregon. Now, before it's time to go, just a little bit of information from Prevention, Finding Your Calm. What is mindfulness? With regular practice, this therapeutic technique can help relieve stress, regulate emotions, and even ease pain and fatigue. This is starting a new section of this exploration. Most of us spend a large portion of our waking hours, about 47%, according to one study, engaged in what psychologists call mind wandering. We end up running on autopilot while we are daydreaming or caught up in thoughts about the past or future, whether it's replaying an argument or planning what to make for dinner. Mindfulness is essentially the opposite, consciously turning our attention to whatever we are doing, thinking, or feeling at that particular moment. It's important to do this neutrally and without judgment, noticing thoughts or sensations with detached interest before letting them go. Guess what? You're not alone if you find mindfulness irksome or difficult. In one study, 67% of men and 25% of women chose to administer painful electric shocks to themselves rather than try to cope with being left alone with their thoughts. Those who have mastered mindfulness suggest that if we practice this technique regularly, we can gain more control over our conscious minds, which in turn reduces our stress. They say it really is possible for us to live more fully in the present and to avoid getting stuck in memories of the past or caught up with concerns about the future. Research is finally catching up to these long-held beliefs, and these studies are revealing even more health benefits than ever before. One way to study the effects is by scanning and examining people's brains while they meditate. In some of the earliest research of this type, conducted on Buddhist monks who had spent tens of thousands of hours meditating, scientists observed high levels of activity in the areas of the brain that control focus and positive emotions. A brief little sidebar here is, be the observer. The next time you're about to lose it, imagine you're watching yourself on a movie screen. By stepping outside of a situation before reacting to it, you'll gain an instant, calming sense of perspective rather than getting caught up in the moment. Now, for the last several weeks, we've been reading from an article, The Games We Play, Tributes to Black Athletes. And these are by people who tell us what they've learned on and off the court. And while they still fight for racial equality for all people of color in America. And sadly, we've come to the end of this article. We only have one left. And this one is Charlie Sifford, 1922 to 2015, the first black golfer to play in the PGA Tour in 1961. Charlie set a great example. He took the hard knocks for us, then stayed and fought for every inch. When I became the first black player to compete at the Masters, it was not a very pleasant week. We had so many catcalls, the N-word, you have no business being here, death threats too. I was boiling inside, but I wouldn't let them see it. Charlie never took the noise people gave him. If someone said something negative, he would always say something back to them. And this observation was by Lee Elder, who's now 86, and he was the first African-American golfer to play in the Masters in 1975. Well, folks, we've run out of time again for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 911. Excuse me, that's not true. Call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.